Hey guys, this is Mike Mahaffey, the old bastard BJJ guy, here for BJJ Metal Models. Back in my day, we had to walk uphill in the snow both ways to get to the academy just to learn some crappy technique from a random purple belt. You kids have it so easy, because now you can just subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium and get tons of great audio courses to learn new techniques, enhance your mindset, and entertain yourself. You can even get personalized rolling reviews from some of your favorite BJJ Metal Models coaches, including me. It's like having your own seminar, you spoiled little whippersnappers. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium right now, get off my lawn, and go train.
Hey, welcome to BJJ Metal Models, episode 279. I'm Steve Kwan. BJJ Mental Models is your guide to a conceptual and intelligent jiu-jitsu approach. And today, I'm joined by a fellow Vancouverite, Stuart Cooper. Stuart, how's it going?
It's going good. Thanks for having me.
I am happy to have you. This is actually the first time you and I have spoken directly. We've exchanged messages many times over the years, I believe. And of course, you're a friend of my brother, Matt, right? I know that you've trained with him. You've recorded with him as well. So you're basically a member of the family now. So welcome aboard.
Oh, thank you. I'm a Vancouver, I know.
That's right. Well, for those who aren't familiar with you, I mean, I'm sure that most people, if not familiar with the name, have probably seen your work, but why don't you go ahead and just do a quick introduction?
Yeah, so I think most people know me from my videos. I started making them back in 2011. And the video that really started my career was the ADCC 2011 highlight. I think that was the very first ADCC highlight that was ever made. And that one just kind of went viral. And it was around that time I started making little videos with Gunnar Nelson, Ryan Hall, Jeff Monson. And then it just kind of took off. So yeah, I've like made a living over the last almost 14, 15 years now, just teaching jiu-jitsu and making videos on different jiu-jitsu athletes.
That is amazing. I actually saw that you recently did a mini documentary on friend of the show, Robert Deagle, right?
I'm actually in the process of, I filmed it. I just haven't edited it together yet. But yeah, there's a bunch ready to go, actually. Mason Fowler, Wagner Rocha, Robert Deagle, and Braulio Stima. So these ones are still, I'm currently editing. It's just taking me a while.
Ah, man, that's awesome. Well,
life gets in the way, you know?
It sure does. Tell me about it. Well, let me ask, let's get the plug out of the way. If people want to watch your stuff or consume your content, or if there's some way to support you financially and actually buy something, how do they go about doing that?
You can actually go to my YouTube channel, Stuart Cooper Films, and I've actually only just set up a Patreon. There's nothing actually on there yet, but I will be posting a lot of content on there very soon, because YouTube just isn't the platform that it used to be. It's not working for me anymore. And I want to carry on making these videos. So if you can go and support me on Patreon, that would be awesome. That would help, you know, allow me to continue making these videos.
Amazing. I will put the links to both of those in the show notes. We actually got our kickstart here on Patreon many, many years ago. We still technically have it, although we steer people more towards our premium website now instead. But I got to say, man, I think people don't understand the difference that it makes if you support your favorite creators on Patreon is huge. Even if it's just a dollar here or there, if you've never been on the other side of the YouTube algorithm, you probably don't know how poorly it pays out. The amount of money that you can make off of Patreon in terms of how well you monetize, like, look, if you watch someone's video and an ad plays, they get barely anything. If you give them a dollar on Patreon, you're probably giving them 1,000 times or more than they would be making if you just consumed their content and watched ads. So I always recommend to people, look, it is a boatload of work. People don't understand how much work it is to make content like you do. And that stuff doesn't happen for free. So if you've ever benefited from Stuart's work, I definitely recommend checking out his Patreon. I will, as I always do, put the link in the show notes.
Awesome. Thank you.
You're most welcome, sir. But hey, one of the things that I've discovered as a content creator is that when you're kind of known for making stuff, people tend to not actually know much about what your jiu-jitsu game looks like. They know all about the stuff you put online, but they often don't know much about the person behind the camera or behind the mic. And I mean, I've never rolled with you, but my brother has. He is, as far as I know, the number one no-gi grappler in the province. And he said that you beat the absolute shit out of him, man. So you must know a thing or two about jiu-jitsu. So I want to hear about this. Matt said that you are an amazing pressure player. Tell me about your game here.
Yeah, that's definitely the best part of my game. And over the years, I really enjoyed playing guard. Like, I really like the open guard. But my best position is definitely on top of you doing pressure passing. And over the last few years, I've really got into the body lock style passing.
And I think that actually ties nicely into what I wanted to pick your brain about here. You know, I thought the obvious thing to do is to talk to you about documentaries and film, but I'm sure you've done that ad nauseum. What I want to know is about your jiu-jitsu game. And you'd said that one of the things that you're enjoying and exploring these days is combining different guard passing styles. I love this idea for a conversation. So give me some more, man. Tell me about what that means to you and what you're combining and what your results have been so far.
So I have to give credit to Gordon Ryan for, I think it was a little video I saw on Instagram or something of Gordon Ryan explaining this, but he said there's three types of guard passing. And it really made sense. You've got the pressure passing, the Toriando style passing, and then the submission passing. And then I've really tried to implement this into my game, especially since my last match that I lost, which was against Shane Fishman on Grapplefest. And this is a good example of a match that I got very nervous for, and my intention was to mix it up and do these three types of guard passing to both the left side and the right side. But sometimes when you haven't competed for a while and the nerves get to you, you can get stuck in that tunnel vision. So I went out there and started just doing my best guard pass, which is the body lock pass. So I just went out there, he pulled guard on me, which I knew he would do. And I dove in with double underhooks with the S grip and just started connecting my hands and started trying to apply a variety of body lock passes. But this was a 10-minute match, not a 5-minute match. I'm used to doing 5-minute rounds. And it was actually Roger Gracie I was speaking to recently. It's not good to connect your hands if it's a long match at the beginning of a match and really start squeezing, because you can burn your forearms out very quick. So in that match, I got stuck in tunnel vision just doing one type of guard pass to the left side. And it usually works, but it did not work. And I didn't switch it up halfway through. I just kept doing the same guard pass. And I ended up gassing myself out. My forearms burned up and everything just fell apart after that. So what would have been much better is not only just going to the left. If the body lock pass doesn't work, you have to back up and then maybe try like Toriando style passing, because then you're giving your forearms a break and then you can start getting your breath back and start going to the left side and the right side. So, and also throwing in some guillotine, you know, submission passes in there, Kimura passes. But this is something I'm really trying to get better at in training, and it's something I'm teaching some of my students. And when I do return back to competition, I'm definitely going to be trying a lot more of this.
Absolutely. Something that I have always found is that when you're attacking someone's guard, the problem with the guard is that there's so many things that the person on bottom can do. It is kind of hard to predict exactly what's coming because there's so much fluidity. And a very common mistake that people make is they will have one guard pass in mind and they will just commit 100% to that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did.
Yeah, you especially see this with beginners where, you know, maybe they're going for a knee cut and they get stuck, they get blocked in a knee shield. And rather than doing the sensible thing of kind of backing out and changing the angle, they just keep trying to push through. And that I find that although, look, it can work, the challenge is it gets really predictable. You know, if you're talking a dominant position, if you're hanging out in side control or mount, I think it's okay if you've only got one or two things that you like to do, because those positions are pretty predictable when you're establishing a dominant control like that. But when you're in someone's guard, there's just so much variability and they have so much mobility. It really feels like you got to have a few options and you've got to be willing to switch between them when the timing is right.
Yeah. And I've never really done a Toriando style pass. And I always felt like it gave too much space, which it does. Cause let's say you do one of the Toriando passes and you pass the legs, you pass the knees, there's still a lot of distance there. But what I have found that it does, it might open up, it might give you the chance to get to a chest to chest position. Maybe the Toriando doesn't completely pass the guard, but allows you to get over at least one or both of the knees into a chest to chest position. And then you can start applying the pressure passing from there. So I find for me, it's mixing up the Toriando left and right, and that will open up a more pressure passing form.
Absolutely. The other benefit too to the Toriando is even if you don't really like doing that pass, and it's not one of my favorites, but when you punch down on someone's legs like that, they're not going to want to leave their legs like that. Their instinct is going to be to try to get their legs the hell up in the air right away. And so that chains really nicely into something like a double underpass or a stack pass, right? If their legs are down, you try to punch them down. If they manage to bring them up, you just underhook the legs and there you go, right? They chain together quite nicely. And then you've always got something to do regardless of where your opponent has their legs configured. I think a mistake many people make is they've got maybe one pass they're really good at, but unless their opponent is in that exact position to make that pass work, they just don't have any game at all.
Yeah, I find that they're quite efficient as well. If I get my guard passed, very rarely do I get my guard passed if someone's trying to pressure pass me. But if someone's doing the Toriando stuff, going left and right, and they're really fast, and I don't have a connection to them, that's where I get my guard passed the most. It's actually the Toriando stuff. So because it gets the person on the bottom tired.
Yeah, absolutely. I find it's the same. I am used to people coming at me really close range and trying to apply tons of pressure. It's when people back off that I tend to struggle more.
Right.
I think part of it is a body type thing too. I tend to have shorter limbs. You know, I got those Quan genetics like Matt. And I find for that body type, getting in close and tight is most effective. And if someone is longer than me and they like to play distance passing, it's a real battle for me to fight those people off. So that's another thing too, right? It doesn't just matter what passes you want to do. It also depends on your opponent's body type and their game. Having more options makes it easier to work around them.
Absolutely. I mean, let's say you're going up against like in ADCC rules where everyone, it is pretty the most part, wants to stand up and wrestle. The Toriando passes will work against someone like Shane Fishman, who's pretty much a guard player. But if you're going up, let's say you manage to get a sweep or a takedown on top of a good solid wrestler, if you have that distance, they're going to stand right back up. So it's learning to do the Toriando style without, you know, like keeping hold of the feet or the ankles so they can't stand back up.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I would ask in your journeys here, what are some other examples of connected passing techniques you found that worked really well? I mean, you brought up some great examples there with the Toriando, but anything else that's really stood out to you where you found two styles that combine and they're greater than the sum of their parts?
I'm not sure what you mean.
I guess what I'm asking is, can you think of any other examples of two different passes that transition really cleanly into each other? So maybe one that goes into another. Like I said, an example that I like is going from the Toriando, where if they try to raise up their legs, then I try to scoop underneath them because you're just going with the motion.
One thing I'm really playing around with right now is the kind of the Gordon Ryan kind of Wagner Rocha. Is it like the flow passing, kind of like the tripod passing? I'm really enjoying that right now, where I'm just basically really like sprawling on their knees and making sure my hands are on my opponent's body. And the only thing that's on the ground is my toes and making my opponent carry my weight. And then just after a few minutes of wearing them down, then you can start to basically find a way past the knee shield, find a way over the knees into a chest-to-chest position. But that's like that kind of guard passing requires like a lot of patience. And I remember when I trained with Wagner Rocha last year, that's what he was doing to me. Like the first few rounds, I felt like my guard, well, the first few minutes, I felt like my guard was doing pretty good. But then he has a way of just leaning on you, making you carry his weight. And then after like minute 4, 5, 6, your core and your legs are just completely burning up. And then, yeah, everything just starts to collapse. You know, your knee shield and your frame start to become weak. And then that's what Wagner calls it. He's like cooking you just for a few minutes. And then he can start to overtake you. So this is something I'm starting to play around with as well.
Yeah, float passing is something that for me, just I think because of the generation that I'm in, I've always kind of struggled with it a bit because I was always taught you do not want to put your weight on someone in that manner where you're elevated and they're under you, because the idea is that they can sweep you, they can easily just tip you over. All of these things are true.
They are true, yeah.
Yeah, but the beauty of float passing is that if you do that enough, it's sort of like playing butterfly guard, where you just learn to be very reactive and just reposition your body so that they are never really quite able to do that. And although I am not a great float passer, when people do it to me, I freaking hate it. Because like you said, it's so tiring. You're supporting their body weight and you're terrified that if you move one way or the other, they're just going to fall off into side control. It's a scary thing to be under is a good float passer.
Yeah, it's incredible watching the way Gordon does it as well. It's like he's so effective with it and it just breaks his opponents. And then they go from like, we all know Patrick Gaudio has a good guard and he made like after a few minutes, his guard just looked, he didn't have a guard of a black belt, a world-class black belt anymore.
Yeah, I guess that's another benefit to float passing is that it's good for energy conservation.
Yeah, sufficient for you on top, isn't it?
Exactly. And I love positions like that where you are burning through their energy faster than you are yours. The problem with a lot of guard passing techniques is they do often require a decent amount of energy to use. But float passing, you just kind of just float on top of them, right? And as long as your balance is good, you're always going to be safe.
Yeah, it's a really good thing to do with the positional sparring as well. Just Me and a few of my students been getting together during the week and just doing a few rounds, like in the daytime. And we're starting from a lot of the tripod float pass position. And you're exactly right. You're good at the first, when you actually start trying this at first, you're going to get swept. You're going to lose your balance. But that's why you do the positional training, you know, just to get better at that position.
You know, some positions and some techniques, you start to see results really quickly. And I think that those are techniques that people obviously gravitate towards, because who doesn't want to see results quickly? But there's also a lot of other techniques and positions that often you don't get quick results. It takes a while to build up the feeling to actually be able to do them successfully. And I think float passing, again, I talked about butterfly guard. These would be examples of positions where most of the time, the first time you try this, you're going to fail miserably. And it's easy to get discouraged and think, well, that I'm not doing that again. That shit don't work. You know, why would I do that when my close guard game works just great? But the problem is, you're leaving a lot of good tools on the table. And sometimes once you invest deeper into those techniques, all of a sudden, once it clicks and you get the fluidity, you can start seeing real results.
Yeah, it really does. It takes time to understand certain positions. There's certain guard passes and certain ways of playing guard, which anyone can do, and you can kind of get the results right away. But there's others where you really do have to put the time into that position. You have to fail and fail again and fail again. Just like you said, sometimes I'll show a guard pass and people are like, oh, this doesn't work. And I'm like, it does, but you just got to put the time in.
Yeah, I think it helps to understand different mechanics that make different guards work, because they're not all the same. I mean, so many gyms to this day, they still teach close guard as kind of the fundamental guard. There's a lot of pushback on that these days, and I'm inclined to agree that maybe it's not the best first guard to teach people. But the thing I like about close guard, though, is that intuitively, it's easy to understand. I can take a day one white belt and make it clear to them what they have to do. You are clamping this person down and you don't want them to move. That's a lot easier than something like a butterfly guard, where it's more about tracking the person and following them, reacting to their movements, and then finding the moments, right? It's a very timing-based thing. So, and you'll see this with float passing too. A lot of these techniques that involve using hooks to kind of float and track and react to a person, those tend to be a little bit more of finesse techniques. And I think they take more time for people to get comfortable with.
Yeah, definitely.
So I would love to know, I mean, in terms of your studies here, is there anything coming up in the guard passing landscape that you think is maybe not quite hit mainstream yet, but is getting there, that has a lot of potential?
Oh, in terms of guard passing, I mean, I definitely think you're seeing a lot of people copy the way Gordon Ryan is doing that kind of the tripod float passing at the moment. And Joseph Chen, I really liked it. I've been studying him a lot as well, what he was doing in the ADCC trials. It was really unusual. So I think these could be the next kind of, style of guard passing to get big. It's like anything, though, eventually it'll come full circle again. There's always something that's like a new trend, isn't it?
That is absolutely true. It's funny. I know that 10 years from now, people are going to be talking about very different things, some new, some old. And it feels like there's never an answer as to whether a technique is good or bad. It's more about the time and what's going on in the rest of the community and the world and what people are focusing on. I mean, trends come and go, right? I wouldn't be surprised if a decade from now, people are training all of the old school stuff that people avoid these days. It's just all cyclical, right?
I tell you who has some really good guard passing that I've noticed, and he just looks like my worst nightmare, is J-Rod. Because he just puts a pace on. He goes pretty much like Toriendo style passing. He's a wrestler, so he just has an endless cardio. He's just going left, right, left, right. I was watching him in, I think it was the last quintet, and he went up against a 10th planet black belt. He was a really good, I can't remember his name. I think it was Amir Alam. And he just shut his guard down. It was incredible to watch.
Yeah, that kind of blitz passing is just a nightmare to deal with.
It's so hard for people to keep up with on the bottom.
Yeah, and it's a perfect example of what you're talking about too, in terms of blending styles. The main way that you do that kind of blitz passing is by switching from one tactic to another and not just relying on the same thing. This is actually a good question I would ask you. When it comes to switching your passing tactics from left to right, or however you do, the most obvious example that people will think of is with the Toriando. Maybe you go left, and if the person blocks you, then you switch and you go right. And if the person blocks you again, then you switch and you go left. But that's still kind of a symmetrical passing strategy. You're using the Toriando whether you go left or whether you go right. I would ask you, do you find that with other passing techniques, do you find them to be as symmetrical as the Toriando, or do you find that there's some things for you that only work if you go left, and there's some things that only work if you go right.
Yeah, I actually find that there's some things that I have certain passes that I do to the left and certain passes that I do to the right. But I find that for me, I like to really pressure pass to the left. So recently what I've been doing is doing a lot of that tripod passing, leaning into my opponent and making them carry my weight for quite a few minutes. And maybe I don't get past, but then I'll back away. I can feel like when they're getting tired, I'll back away and then I'll quickly start going to the right. So I'm pressure passing to the left, and then I'll do a Torriendo to the right. And the one that I've been adding in is the Thai Rotolo one, where you step on the leg, you grab the outside hook, step on the knee, and then the back of the head, and then go to the other side.
Yeah, that actually is something that I think is worth talking about, that some passes are symmetrical, meaning you can do them to the left or the right. And those kind of have that built-in chaining ability because you can just switch direction, but others are not. And you've got to have an answer if you want to switch things up.
Yeah.
I mean, the Torriendo is a symmetrical pass. You can go left or right. The double under is a symmetrical pass. Like if you want to stack someone, you can go left or right. But most other passing styles, like a knee cut, for example, if you're going to knee cut to the left versus to the right, or if you're going to try to switch from left to right, it's going to look very, very different. And it might not even be the best way to do things. I've always felt, you tell me if you agree, I'm not a believer that you have to be able to do everything both to the left and to the right. I just think that you have to have an answer either way. It doesn't have to be the same answer. But as long as you're not like Derek Zoolander, where you can only turn in one direction, as long as you have an option in every direction, I don't think it needs to be the same one.
Yeah, as long as you have an option in both directions. I know Marcelo Garcia, he didn't do things both. He didn't drill both sides. I think he had different things on different sides. But then I know George St. Pierre, for example, he's very like OCD and would drill both sides. Now, I'm actually trying to get better. Like I'm like a black belt pressure passing to the left. But then to the right, I'm like, with my pressure pass, I'm like a purple belt. This is something I realized quite a number of years ago. I was training with Craig Jones in Thailand, and he plays half guard. Most people play half guard on their right hip, but he plays half guard on his left hip. And then I could not get him over to my side, you know, the side that I'm better at. And it was in that role, just training with him that whole week, I realized, damn, I'm so bad at passing to the right here. I need to get better at this. And now I'm actually, like, I really emphasize to my students, I think it's good to drill both sides.
Well, I mean, the thing is, even if you as the passer don't want to use the same pass on both sides, you still need to train with the assumption that the other person might. Right. So maybe you only pass to the left every single time using a knee cut. That's all well and good. But you can't assume that your opponent is going to do the same thing. And like you talked about, little things like angling your hips. I mean, you see this in boxing when you talk about fighting orthodox versus southpaw and how confusing that can be. You have a similar thing in jiu-jitsu where so many people, for example, expect that if they're a De La Hiva guard player, they expect that you as the passer are leading with your right leg. But man, if the person puts their left leg forward, that can really mess you up if you're expecting them to lead with their right.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Always make sure you come in with a staggered stance, never a square stance. That's something I really emphasize as well. Is it just giving people that double kawichi on you, the inside position?
Now, there's a good question for you. In terms of stances in jiu-jitsu, do you recommend or play with switching up your stance? I mean, personally, I always lead with my right foot. I think a lot of people do, but are you of the mind that it's best to just pick a stance you like and go with it? Or do you ever switch it up and then lead with your right, then at some point switch to leading with your left for a different passing strategy?
I've always, you know, all these years, I've always lead with my right leg. But over the last few months, I've actually started to go to the other side and lead with my left leg.
It's a great way to mess people up because so many things that they take for granted, like where your lapels are going to be and where your leg is going to be, they just fall apart if you switch and you lead with the other leg. And having the ability to do that, again, who is it? It was Rafael Lovato Jr. actually was doing a seminar up here in Vancouver a while ago. And one of the things that he said was that he's observed that, of course, in MMA, everyone's always worried about their footwork and they're thinking very deliberately about where their feet go. But he noticed that, look, in jiu-jitsu, nobody thinks about this stuff.
Oh, they don't.
They just take for granted that feet are going to be where they want them to be. And if you know that, if you know that your opponent is a De La Hiva player and they usually expect you to lead with your right leg, and then you put your left leg forward, you've really taken away their ability to use their best guard. And that's just going to make it easier for you to pass.
And another thing, going back to that Shane Fishman match, that's really focusing on is the pacing of my guard passes as well. Because if you just stick with, you know, going with body lock passes. If it's a 10-minute match, like I said, you're going to gas yourself out. So you really need to pace yourself and, you know, train yourself for like these little sprints. I remember being at Aptos years ago. That's what they were actually doing. They would have like a timer on, and then one person comes in and you just have like a 30-second sprint of trying to pass the guard. But you can only do that for like, you can't sprint and really force a pass for longer than 30 seconds. You're going to get gassed out. So it's like training your body to have like a little sprint with that guard pass. Maybe it doesn't work, reset, maybe you go to Toriando, go to the other side, and, you know, get your breathing back, and then you can go back in, you know, have another sprint.
That's also something that people don't think about much when it comes to passing. The only person I've met who has talked extensively about this is Margo Ciccarelli, which is understanding not just the technique that you're doing from guard, but the rhythm and the timing.
Exactly, yeah.
And understanding that you can shake it up. It's way too easy to fall into a rhythm that becomes predictable. I mean, if you're always doing slow glacial pressure passing, your opponent learns from that. Or if you're always trying to blitz and be quick, they're going to learn from that too. But it's very hard to time an opponent if they switch their cadence. And something that Margo has talked about is actually training with metronomes and things to try to follow a rhythm and then to try to break the rhythm and confuse their opponent. And I think that, I mean, that is an amazing way to confound an opponent, is to go from a very, very slow, methodical style to switch up to something fast and then to slow down again. It makes it really hard for them to know where they need to guard against, how tense they need to be, what's going to happen next. It just always keeps them guessing.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do, is like maybe pick one guard pass and then you switch it up. They think you're doing one thing, and then as soon as they get used to that pass, that position, then you switch it up, go the other way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I would ask you then, I mean, while we're talking about this, does your passing game, and I know you're best known probably for a lot of no-gi work, but do you train in the gi, and do you find that that makes a difference in terms of your passing strategy? Or
my passing is very much the same in the gi, actually. I don't do much gi. Last time I did it was, I probably trained like 5 times in the gi for the last 6 months. It's completely, yeah, the two are moving further and further apart, but my passing is still very similar in the gi.
That tracks. I mean, I am not an ace competitor by any stretch, but I have found that although the games have diverged in a lot of ways, the passing that I do is not notably different, whether it's gi or no gi. I mean, there's adjustments you have to make. You talked about the Toriando, right? The Toriando, you're going to have very specific grips if you're doing that in the gi, for instance. But I do a lot of knee cut passes, double under passes, back step passes. And I find that although I have different handles to grab onto, at the end of the day, the actual passing is not changing that much between gi and no gi. I guess really the only difference is in the gi, if I get good solid grips and I hunker down, I'm a lot more confident I can stay there if I want to stay there. Whereas in no gi, even if I feel relatively comfortable, I have to understand that an explosive opponent can probably make enough space quickly to change things up.
Yeah, actually, I find my gi passing's not actually that bad at all. But then when I'm playing guard, like, I don't get my guard passed very much in no gi, but I get it passed all the time in the gi.
Yeah, well, just the difference in grips, right? There's so many other options.
Yeah, I use my left hook a lot in the no gi. Just I follow my opponent, always keeping that inside position, but with the gi, people are able to grab, you know, the pant leg, pin it down, take my hook out, and then pin it to the ground. And then, yeah, I just get my guard passed easily.
Actually, Matt was just, my brother was just on the podcast recently, and we were just talking about this and how, assuming that the gi is not there, for most people, it's probably a good idea to seek the inside channel, to go for underhooks, to try to fight on the inside. But for certain people, especially with certain body types, but especially in the gi, often they can go around to the outside because the gi grips allow them to do things like, you know, invert around and take your back and do all sorts of stuff that is easier to do in the gi just because of the presence of those handles. So that is one thing that you have to be mindful of in the gi when you're passing. You just because you have the inside channel does not mean you're safe, right? The person can still get to your back quite easily. Whereas in no gi, if you're making it a phone booth fight where you're in tight and you've got inside control, it's going to be real hard for them to do anything. In the gi, though, they do still have options.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
One other thing you mentioned, which I definitely want to expand upon, you talked about the importance of playing the distance and how when you're moving forward with a pressure-based guard, at some point in time, you might need to back off and shake things up and go to a different guard. And a big part of that, it's not just that you're switching the passing technique, it's that you're also changing the distance. You're moving in and out. And again, much like how in boxing, people talk about footwork, they also talk about distance a lot. And in jiu-jitsu, that I think also doesn't get enough love, the conversation about managing that distance. Any thoughts on that and how to play the distance when you're attacking someone's guard?
Yeah, I mean, it's good to like, you don't want your opponent to have like 2-on-1 grips to you or get like a really solid connection. Using a body lock pass and I'm really wearing my opponent down, but it's not working. I mean, you just got to know when to switch it up. Can you explain a bit more?
Yeah, just thinking some guard passes work best if you're in tight. Some work best if you're further away. And a big part of knowing how to attack someone's guard is knowing when it's time to back off and when it's time to close the distance. Like a common example that I often give people is if you're stuck in someone's knee shield and you're trying to crowd them and pressure them, it's probably not going to work because you just can't ram yourself through their knee. So usually the way you defeat the knee shield is you back off a bit and you change the angle. But that requires you to know that, okay, I'm not going to clear this knee shield because the homie's shin is digging into my stomach. So like, when do you switch from close range combat to far combat, and what are kind of the rules for when you would want to do that?
Yeah, I suppose when I'm doing a pressure passing and I feel that, you know, I can't get past the knee shields, like the knee shield is really holding up strong. They're keeping their right knee connected to the right elbow. They're getting the frames very strong. You've just got to know when to back up and then switching the Toriyano style pass or maybe create a bit of distance. Sometimes people don't realize their head like quite forward off the mat, and then that's a good time to do the guillotine pass, to get a good chin strap and do a forward roll and maybe then clear the knee shield that way.
Okay, I want to talk to you about this because I don't think we've ever discussed it on the podcast. The guillotine pass is one of my favorite passes to do.
I absolutely love this pass now. It's really part of my game.
I was never taught this. I didn't even know it was a thing. But at some point, I was in my opponent's half guard and they had their head off the ground and it was kind of within grabbing distance. And I realized I could probably just throw myself at this person and just land my giant fat body on top of their head and just try to choke them. And what I found was, okay, first of all, a lot of the time you will just get the submission from doing that, because getting attacked with a guillotine from top half guard, it's hard to get out of there. But even if it didn't work, it would almost always force my opponent to give up the pass because it's just way too hard to block a guard pass and defend a choke at the same time. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on the guillotine pass, where you learned it and what you like about it so much.
So I actually started doing the guillotine pass after training with Josh Inger quite a few years ago. He came to Thailand when I was still at Tiger Muay Thai, and he has one hell of a chin strap. And I remember he was just on top, and as soon as he gets that thing, it just makes you panic and it makes you flip-flop around and you want someone to pass your guard or you'll give up the sweep. So after training with him, that's when I really realized how you don't need to use the guillotine just for a submission, just like the Kimura. I mean, trying to finish a Kimura on someone big and strong is very, very difficult. But you can use that Kimura lock to set up other guard passes, sweeps, other submissions, just like the guillotine as well. So it's also knowing the right time to go for the guillotine pass. So for me, I won't show, you know, my cards right away. You know, I'm trying to do some pressure passing, then some Toriyano style passing. Maybe I still haven't passed the guard. And then maybe a few minutes in, when they least expect it, then throw in like the guillotine pass. So, you know, they least expect it. You just throw it in, pressure pass and Toriyano pass. And then just like I said, when they least expect it.
Yeah, I find that the guillotine pass for me works the best when I catch them sleeping. They're kind of in transition between two things. And they're so busy trying to fight off a knee cut or something like that.
They're focusing on the knee shield or something, right?
Yeah, they lose track of where their head is and they forget that they've allowed their head to drift, you know, a good half foot too close to me, to the point where I can now just slingshot and land on their head in a guillotine. Another situation where this has come up a lot for me, especially with modern grappling, is people trying to spiral underneath me from like reverse De La Hiva or something. This happens a lot. This is probably the most common way I defeat that position. I tend to have a very low stance, and so it's always hard to get under me anyway. But if people try to go for a kiss of the dragon or something like that, they have to be very careful because there's that middle range where if their head comes too close, but they don't succeed in getting right underneath you, they're right in the position to have their head grabbed. And I mean, the thing about that's so great about the guillotine pass is you don't even have to have a great guillotine to make that work. Because like you said, you get value out of it, even if you can't finish the submission. Just the fact that you're grabbing someone's head, you can have the shittiest guillotine in the world, but that control is still very powerful and very threatening. And even if your intent is not to finish it at all, the person must respond to the threat.
Yeah. And even if you just land, maybe you don't get the submission, but even if you just get over one of the knees or both the knees and chest to chest, that's great. Then you can start working a different pass from there.
Exactly. And I mean, I think that touches into what you talked about earlier, this idea of submission-based passing, which I love. I mean, people always talk about how you need to focus on position over submission, but something that I know Rob Bernacki has talked about with us before is playing submissions as a position and understanding that you can use submission-based control as a position to advance up the chain. You talked about kimuras. It wasn't that long ago that kimuras were considered to be a big man's technique. And it was just decided that a smaller person could never do a kimura against a bigger person. But that was based off of the assumption that your goal is to tap them and finish them from bottom half guard or something, right? When you stop looking at the kimura as a submission and you look at it as a control that you can use to advance and to sweep and to get to the back, suddenly it becomes way more valuable and suddenly smaller people can use it to great effect. And it's the same with the guillotine.
Yeah, I mean, I very rarely get kimura submissions, but I use it all the time to pass the guard. Maybe they're in butterfly guard and I've got the wrist. I've got one leg on the inside. I grab their wrist and then jump over the head for the kimura lock and you end up in the TV position, you know? So it sets up like back takes, it sets up reverse triangles, arm bars, all kinds of things. And the only time I might get a kimura every now and again, but if you think about the kimura, it's two arms against two arms. So if I'm actually going to finish the kimura, like I'll switch it to a Tiriko plotter instead, because you're swapping one of your arms with one of your legs, which is, you know, the strongest part of your body.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably the main thing that makes kimuras harder to finish for smaller people is that just in terms of an arms race, quite literally, it's your two arms versus the other person's two arms. So to really be able to get a finish there, you probably need a strength advantage, but to hold that control and use the rotational power to get behind them and to get past the position, it's so awesome. And I think the guillotine, though, is even more powerful in a lot of ways because no matter how big and strong the person is, their neck is still vulnerable. There's no one who's so big that their neck is, you know, their neck is too big to attack. And so the beauty of a guillotine is you don't even have to worry about that. Is you can be in there with a super heavyweight, but as soon as you grab onto their head, they must respect it at all times.
I mean, it completely takes the focus away from whatever they were doing. They are now just focusing on the neck. They have to address it.
Absolutely.
And with the kimura, it's amazing how much control you can have over your opponent's body with just having two of your arms locked in one of their arms. And it just opens up so much, so many possibilities.
Yeah, it's an incredible control. And to the point where I kind of wonder if it makes sense to even treat it as a submission first and foremost. I kind of feel like the main benefit of the kimura is the positional control it offers, not the ability to get a tap. Like you said, I don't see many people, especially smaller people, get a lot of kimura submissions, but using the kimura to like leapfrog and slice through someone's guard and get to the crucifix or get to their back, that it is so deadly for that.
Yeah, I mean, they're the only two submissions I use actually right now. Do you know of any others? I know I use the kimura and the guillotine pass. Submission passes. They're the two that I use. I'm trying to think of any others.
I will sometimes, I'm not going to say this is a high level thing to do, but I do like to goof around at the gym. I will sometimes do a straight ankle lock with the intent of getting a pass.
Right. That's what I was thinking, like a leg lock.
Yeah.
Pass.
Because what happens sometimes is if I'm playing against someone with a really stubborn open guard, I will just drop down as if I want to hit them with an ankle lock. And to make them think that now we're playing leg entanglement games. But what I'm often trying to do on the ground is drag their leg across and stand back up into a leg drag. So,
Yeah.
So there's options you can do there. That to me is one because it fools people because you're sitting down, you're coming to the floor and they think, oh, we're in leg spaghetti now. And then you get right back up into a classic passing position and it really messes people up because it's so unexpected.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe going for a leg entanglement when you drop back, it removes that knee shield when you come back on top.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, people often don't want to do it because it feels bad to go from standing to seated. But if you can control their feet, you can prevent them from taking advantage of that and from standing up on you. So sometimes if I'm really battling with the person's feet, I will fall back and I'll use the appearance of a leg threat to really just kind of move their legs out of the way and then just get back up.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of anything else. I mean, look, some people will do crazy exotic stuff. I've been guilty of this, like trying to punch choke someone from inside their guard. That probably is not an A+ passing strategy. Although I will say this, you can get people to move pretty quick if you do surprising things to them. I mean, I don't think it's definitely going to take the world by storm, but sometimes just going for an unorthodox submission when you're on top, it's enough to fluster the person and throw them off.
Oh, that's a just fun one. One that I really like to do is the back step. A good example, I learned this from watching Gordon Ryan versus Yuri Simoes. And I think it was 2017 on Kasai Grappling. So right after Gordon ran the 88-kilogram division, and Yuri actually won the 99-kilogram division. If you go back and watch that match, several times Gordon backsteps in the half guard, and it makes Yuri think about the legs. And then he comes up in his right elbow. But what that does, it gives him the space underneath where Gordon Ryan reaches underneath and gets double wrist control, pulls the wrist in, and then uses his other foot to clear his leg out of the half guard position into a back take. I don't know if you remember that match, but this is a technique I like to use all the time.
That's really awesome. And I think the thing that really drives home is the power of a submission threat is that it hides your intentions a lot of the time. The person thinks you're going for a submission, and so they're defending a submission. But what you're really doing is you're trying to maneuver their arms and legs out of the way so that you can advance the position. It's a very powerful threat. If you're trying to just pass someone, they know that there's a pass coming and they know what they have to deal with. But when you're attacking them with a submission, it's almost a dilemma situation because they have to respect both the threat of the tap and the threat of the pass at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. You're creating a dilemma and you're diverting their thinking. You know, you're setting up a trap, you know, seeing if they're going to take the bait.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I've always found that that's honestly, if I'm fighting someone who's bigger or stronger or just flat out better than me, that's going to be my best bet, right? Is to try to be sneaky and unorthodox and make them think I'm going...
Try and outthink them, yeah.
Exactly. Never want to fight those guys pound for pound, but if you can figure out a way to make them so confused about where the threat is coming from that they go in the wrong direction, it's way easier than trying to force them out of their game plan.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I mean, I would ask here, because it sounds like you've studied a lot of resources here. When it comes down to building a diverse guard passing game like this, any athletes who come to mind that you really like to study? I mean, you already mentioned a few, but if you have any instructional recommendations or tape study that you would suggest, or even documentary you've made that might be useful, I would definitely love to get the recommendation here.
I study only the best guys because I want to see what the best guys are doing to the best guys. So I watch a lot of how Craig Jones passes guard because he's more known as a guard player, but his guard passing is absolutely amazing. And that's actually who I learned the body lock pass off years ago. I was training with him and Lachlan Giles. Obviously, Gordon Ryan, I study a lot. So who else? And Vagner Rocha. I really like. And Nicky Rodriguez. Nicky Rodriguez has a very good different types of body lock passes. But the way I learn is I'll watch a match. And then let's say Gordon passes Vagner Rocha's guard. Because I've trained with Vagner. I could not get close to passing his guard at all. So immediately afterwards, I'm watching how Gordon Ryan did it. And I'm watching it step by step. You know, so I do have instructionals, but I actually find I learn more from watching matches. And actually, little clips from Instagram as well. What I'll do is I'll get the repost app. So I might see a cool little sequence on Instagram. I'll download that little sequence onto my phone through the repost app, but then I can watch it frame by frame. And I'll write down on a piece of paper, like step one, step two, step three. And I'll keep writing it down. And then I'll like watch it again. And then I'll try and visualize, you know, what they actually did and then write it down without watching it. And then I'll go to the gym and I'll pick out some, you know, a decent blue belt to roll and I'll start trying it on them. And then I'll work up to like purple, brown, and then until it's in my game and I can try it on black belts.
That's a good point. I have felt for the last while that the value of traditional video instructionals is probably a bit overhyped. For a variety of reasons, I think part of it is that because they are often expensive, I feel like instructors sometimes feel the need to pad them longer than they actually need to be, and that kind of just wastes everyone's time. But the other thing too is that a lot of the time people don't really know what it is that makes things work. I've certainly been guilty of this where I think I know how I grapple, but then when I watch footage of myself, I realize I'm actually doing something different. And the beautiful thing about comp footage is it can't lie, right? It can't misunderstand. It either worked or it didn't. And it's an example of what actually works against real resistance at a high level, not necessarily what you can do against a paid uki who's helping you make an instructional and is invested in making you look good, right? I'm more interested in the techniques that work when the best in the world are trying to prevent you from executing them. I sort of feel like tape study and deep analysis there is an underloved area of the sport and an underloved method of study. I mean, of course, you consume a lot of video footage due to your job.
Yes. Yeah.
I would love to hear about your process in terms of study and how you involve tape, because it sounds like that's kind of more your thing.
Yeah. I've got loads of instructionals. And I will, years ago, I was really studying the Danaher back system and the Kimura system. They basically took David Avellan's Kimura system and just added to that and made it much easier to understand. But I find that for me, I won't sit there and watch the whole thing. I'll just watch one little section. So I remember learning the straight jacket system. I would watch it, write it down in the morning, and then I'd go to class and I'd just pick someone out for, again, like a blue belt, and I'd try it on them. And maybe I forget something. And then the next day, I'll watch it again and I'll go back to the gym and I'll try it again. And then I just focus on that one straight jacket system until I get it to work. And then I'll go on to the next part. So it's just like a little bit at a time, because if you just sit there and watch, like, you know, an hour of the instructional, you're not going to remember 95% of it. So just focusing on a little bit at a time. And then once I got the back system down, then I went into the Kimura system, because that really ties in very well with it. And then on top of that, yeah, just some of the matches, you know, with the best guys.
Now, one other thing I would ask, just on the topic of study here, if you wanted to study footage, I know what the challenge a lot of people have is, I mean, anyone can go and watch a competition match, but it takes a very keen and experienced eye to be able to pick out the details of what's actually useful there. I mean, if you take a blue belt, for example, and you have them watch a high-level no-gi match where people are moving 100 miles an hour, they may not understand the small things that are very critical and meaningful there. I mean, one of the things that we do on our premium service is we will actually break down the footage for people. But there are also content creators out there who specialize in breaking things down. I know, for example, a good example is Less Impressed, More Involved, right?
Yeah, they're really good. I was watching one of those the other day. I think they did one on Gordon Ryan, Patrick Gaudio.
Probably. Yeah, the guy behind that, Jake Luigi, the craziest thing is he's a purple belt. And I think that, you know, what's interesting is every time he posts something, some a-hole crawls out of the woodwork and says, why should I listen to you? You're just a purple belt. And it's like, look, I know a lot of black belt world champions who follow that dude, because he might be a purple belt in terms of personal mat experience, but he's absolutely a black belt in terms of analytical capability.
Yes. Yeah. He obviously really understands it and really understands the concepts. I mean, sometimes I'll post one of my matches on Instagram or something or YouTube, and then I'll get some white belt telling me what I should have done different. I'm like, thanks.
My favorite is I posted a reel on Instagram a while back from one of our guests who it was a clip of them competing in a world championship match, I believe, or at least in a very, very high level tournament. And someone in the comments posted and said, you know, that's a nice idea, but it would never work at the highest levels. And I'm thinking, like, my guy, yeah, this is literally footage where we're literally talking about a grappler who literally does this at the highest levels. I just think it's funny how people sometimes they jump to that conclusion, but they don't understand who they're talking about.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking of some other YouTube channels that I study. Demetrius Johnson, he actually has a few good breakdowns. He broke down the Gordon Ryan Patrick Gaudio match recently as well.
I have noticed that DJ has been moving a lot towards like analytical content, which is awesome. I love that guy. I think he is just an amazing mind for the sport, and people only think of him as being one of the, you know, the greatest flyweights of all time, but in terms of his ability to speak about the stuff, yes, he's very good. I mean, if people aren't following Demetrius Johnson on Instagram, I definitely recommend it, because it seems like most of what he posts nowadays is fight breakdowns.
Yeah. I mean, he's incredibly technical as well. I remember someone actually posted the other day, I had no idea about this, but it was from a match, one of his UFC fights against Joseph Benavidez many, many years ago, before the Danaher systems were out. And he's doing the kip and escape. He gets mounted and he starts doing the kip and escape into single leg X and then goes for the outside heel hook. And this is way before, you know, this content was out for us to see.
In MMA, that's, you know.
In MMA as well. Yeah, I had no idea.
It's funny because I love single leg X, but I've always assumed, you know, it seems like conceptually, it should work fine in MMA as long as you can get there without getting clocked. But I still don't see a lot of it. So that's a cool example. I might have to go and look that up.
It's a good way, a good match to watch was Alistair Overeem versus Curtis Blaydes. And he actually uses, because Curtis Blaydes was obviously, he's a world-class wrestler, takes Alistair Overeem down a number of times. But every time Overeem got taken down, he would use the single leg X and the fret of the outside heel hook or footlock to get back up, because every time he went for that position, Curtis Blaydes would back away, then there was space and Alistair Overeem back on his feet.
Yeah, you know, we talked earlier about using leg locks to chain into passing sequences, and this is exactly what I'm talking about. Sometimes if I just feel like I can't get past this person's guard, I will fall back into kind of an ankle lock, and if they get up, they're basically just in single leg X, which is one of my personal best sweeping positions. So which I find, especially as a smaller person, is easy to chop people back down. The hardest thing I've always found about single leg X is getting into that position safely. Once I'm in there, I'm going to get the sweep for sure. But the problem is getting into that position, you've got to go through a lot of layers of defense, and it's hard to do that without getting your guard passed. So I find sometimes, yeah, making the person think that what you're really trying to do is ankle lock them, but then what you're actually trying to do is get into some sort of like single leg X or leg drag situation. That's always a lot of fun when you're trying to pass someone's guard and you want to get creative.
Yep. And one thing I'm actually doing now is, let's say I've actually passed a guard, you know, and I'm in side control or mount, but I can't get any upper body submissions. Maybe their elbows are so tight, just there's nothing opening up for me. What I'll do is I'll actually allow my opponent, and I want them to think this, I want them to think they're actually catching me in a quarter guard. They're actually getting some kind of guard back. And as soon as they trap that foot, I just backstep into the half guard and then go into a leg entanglement. Or if they address that leg entanglement and come up in the elbow, we go into that double wrist control into the back take. So like John Danaher says, with that new position, the saddle, jiu-jitsu is always a one-directional sport. You know, you go past the legs and towards the head and go for upper body submissions. But now it's okay to go back into the legs. So now it's like a two-directional sport.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is something that we've talked about a bit recently here too, which is just allowing the person to re-guard, at least to recover the quarter guard, because a quarter guard is such a useless thing, but people can't help but try to take it, right? It's just too tempting. It's like a moth to the flame. Everyone is just trained that they need to recover the guard no matter what cost. And I mean, even in the gi, if you're playing under an IBJJF system, you're basically point farming there. You allow the person to recover the quarter guard, then you just pass again. Or like you said, if you're in a rule set that allows it, like a no-gi rule set, it makes it easier to get into a lot of leg entanglements, just backstep into the saddle or something like that.
I actually remember the last IBJJF tournament I ever did, it was actually Blue Belts European Championships, and that was my game plan. Every time I got on top in half guard, I would pass into side control and mount. I would purposefully let them get my leg back into half guard, but I wouldn't allow the knee shield to come in. I would keep that upper body cross face control and then pass again into mount. So every time you pass into mount, that's 3 points for the pass, 4 points for the mount. So I just kept racking up points, allow them to get that half guard back, but then just get the instep in, push down, pass again. And a lot of the matches were, I remember my team were calling me Stewie No Subs because I didn't submit anyone. But every match was something like 16-20-0. And I ended up fighting Tim Spriggs in the finals. This was a long time. This was 2011.
Oh, man.
I ended up losing to Tim 3-2.
It's like a time capsule. Hey, man, a lot to cover there, but you know, any closing thoughts on guard passing? Because I want to make sure that we take some time to talk about your work. But before then, just if there's anything else you wanted to add or talk about, feel free to share.
No, I think it's, yeah, when you're guard passing. Actually, yeah, a concept I'm really trying to get over to my students right now. If you think about what you're doing when you're playing guard, is you want that concave shape. You want your knees inside of your elbows. Okay, and you want to be kind of on your side. So when you're on top, your aim when you're passing guard is to separate the knees from the elbows and then eventually get both shoulders flat and the elbows above the head. So when I'm passing guard, I'm like, right, your aim right now is to get over at least one of those knees and then clear the other knee. And then once you've passed the knees into side control and mount, then it's to get the elbows above the head.
Brilliant point. That is something that I always like to tell people because it helps simplify.
Exactly. It's simple. Roger Gracie walks around with a t-shirt saying jiu-jitsu is simple. And it really is. When you think about it, you start to understand the concepts. It's really simple. But to the untrained eye, and when you watch two of these young grapplers like the Rotolo twins going at it, it just happens so fast. They're like, whoa, what the fuck are they doing? No, but when you slow it down, it's actually quite simple.
Yeah, it's really, like you said, I mean, what are you doing when you're trying to pass someone's guard? You're trying to get around their legs. You're trying to cut their body in half, separate the elbows from the knees, and you're trying to pin them to the mat. That's basically it. I find that thinking about things in those in that simple sense is a lot more productive than trying to think about 800 different passing techniques that may or may not work in any given moment.
Yeah. So let's say I'm passing to the left, you know, I'm doing one of my pressure passes. My focus is right. All I'm focusing on right now is getting my left knee over their right knee into the, is it called the J point, right to the hip? So once my left knee is there, then my next focus is to get that knee shield out of the way. And once that's out of the way, my focus is to get the shoulders pinned. And then I can start to pass from there.
Awesome. Well, let's talk about your work. I mean, you talked about some of the upcoming things that you've got on the go, but let's also talk about what's already there. If people want to check out your stuff, what can they expect?
If you go to my YouTube channel, you'll see I've got videos there with, of course, so many people now. Roger Gracie, Braulio Estima, Ryan Hall, Gunnar Nelson. The ones I've actually got coming up are with Wagner Rocha and Mason Fowler and Robert Deagle as well. And it was really interesting. I learned a lot from making these videos because not only do I get to train with the athlete, I get to pick their brain when I sit down and do the interviews. And when I go home and I'm editing the footage, you know, I'm getting to really study, you know, a lot of their game and what they do. I was really impressed. I've got to say, rolling with Mason Fowler, I have not had my ass handed to me for like that for a long time. That guy is good. And I really hope we get to see him face Gordon, because I really do think he's the one that can give him a lot of problems.
I've actually been meaning to get Mason on the podcast at some point. I would love to do that.
Yeah, he's a good dude. Really great guy.
Yeah. But yeah, like we were talking about before we recorded, so much of the content in the jiu-jitsu landscape is pretty low effort at the end of the day. People will turn on their camera, they'll record something, and they'll post it up there. And this is always my criticism of other podcasts, is they kind of just record and put stuff up and don't really think about, okay, is this valuable? Can we edit this to make it clearer, to improve it? It's just hit record for the content, get it out there. There's not much thought that's put into it. And it's the same for video. But the thing I've always loved about your work is you're kind of the closest we've got in the jiu-jitsu space to like a basically a documentary specialist, right? Someone who tries to make jiu-jitsu documentaries, not just shoot footage on their phone, but actually make like production worthy content in video form. So I've always loved your stuff. I mean, I know you've of course got a reputation for being one of the best in the business there, but especially since so much of that stuff is just freely accessible on YouTube, I definitely suggest people give you a follow if they haven't already.
Yeah, it's funny, when I started making these videos, my aim was to never make them like that. It just kind of happened. I'm like definitely a perfectionist. I mean, when I was at school, it would take me ages to, you know, I was very good at art and design when I was at school. So I'd spend hours and hours, you know, just drawing pictures. But when I first started traveling the world, my idea was just to kind of video blogs, you know, do them really quick, you know, do a quick interview, some quick footage, but I can't help myself. I end up spending hours like, you know, getting the perfect shot and editing it to like some cool music and color grading it. So a lot of time I'm like, right, I'm going to make this video like really quick and just throw it out there, but it never ends up that way.
Absolutely. That was very much the same for me. I originally started this thinking, I'll just turn on a microphone and just share my thoughts on jiu-jitsu. And then before you know it, it just turns into a full-time job, right? And especially if you have an intent to make something that's kind of going to be timeless and always helpful and useful for people and is well-structured, it's a lot more work than people think. And I'm just doing audio. I can only imagine how much more complex it must be if you're doing video too.
Yeah. So now I used to, some of the videos I'm going to do going forward are actually on like different topics, kind of similar to your podcast. I did one a few months ago on the effects of social media, how social media has changed jiu-jitsu. So I pretty much asked that question to every single athlete that I've interviewed over the last couple of years. And it was quite an interesting video, actually, if people have the time to watch it. And another video I have coming out is the importance of weight training, strength and conditioning for jiu-jitsu, where I ask the same question to every single athlete. Just ideas like that.
Awesome. Well, like I said, I will put a link to that in the show notes. I'll also put a link to your Patreon. Anything else that you suggest if people want to follow you or contact you, like an Instagram or?
Instagram's a good place. The two main social media apps that I use are Instagram and YouTube, which is Stuart Cooper Films.
Got it. Awesome. So I will put all of those links in the show notes to make it easy. Just go to your podcast player, hit notes, description, info, whatever it's called, and just tap through. But yeah, I definitely recommend giving all of that stuff a follow. And of course, if you like quality content and you want to support it, that's what the Patreon is for. So I'll put a link to Stuart's Patreon as well. I'll also put a link to our stuff. Everything we make lives at bjjmentalmodels.com. The core podcast is completely free, ad-free as well. Almost 300 episodes now, we're getting there, and it's all intended to be timeless. So the stuff that you get out of the first episode should be just as valuable as the stuff that we do today, even though it was many years ago. We've also got our newsletter. We're closing in on 10,000 subscribers there. It's also free. If you sign up there, you get show notes for the podcast, as well as detailed thought pieces. And every once in a while, I'll throw in a freebie, like an instructional or something from our library, just to make it worth people's time. That's also how you sign up for BJJ Mental Models Premium. That's how we support this whole thing. Join Premium and you get access to our course library. We've got over 100 hours of audio masterclasses on jujitsu thought pieces, featuring some of the best in the world. Beyond that, you also get access to premium only podcasts. Not my dumbass talking. We actually have other hosts. So we've got a lot of stuff that focuses on competition meta analysis and peak performance science. And beyond that, you also get access to our awesome community, and we will do rolling reviews for you. We've got a team of about a dozen world-class black belts who will give you, you know, on the topic of detailed video breakdowns. I personally think that one of the best ways to get good at jiu-jitsu fast is to record yourself and get feedback on what you're doing, because sometimes it's very hard to give good coaching in the moment. Like you said, Stuart, you might only have a 30-second match, but if you record it and send it to someone and they have the ability to pause and stop and really identify what went wrong, man, you could discover some gnarly problems that you've been having in your game, which you probably you probably didn't even know were there. I mean, I wish when I was younger, I had the ability to get that kind of feedback from high-level coaches. We can do it now. I mean, our coaching team has quite literally some of the best in the world, like Margot Ciccarelli, Brianna St. Marie are part of our coaching group. So if you want folks like that to break down your footage, join BJJ Mental Models Premium. First week's free. All of that is at bjjmentalmodels.com. But Stuart, man, thanks a lot. This is a good one. Really appreciate having you on. It was great to talk to a local boy too. And man, I'm looking forward to see what you publish next.
Awesome. Yeah, no, thank you for having me on.
Most welcome, sir. Thanks to the listeners as well. We'll talk to you next time. Take care.